Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Matt from King of Prussia.
Hi, everybody. I'm extremely nervous. I just want to get the cat out of the bag. I always get nervous when I speak. I get nervous when I speak to 20 people for a half an hour. So this is a big, big step for me. But this program's about, you know, spreading the message, and it's not about me. So when I'm asked to be in service, I try to, you know, step up and be in service. So, but I'm definitely out of my comfort zone up here. So, yeah, I grew up in the mean streets of King of Prussia, had a pretty normal childhood. You know, I had two parents that loved me, and I was pretty much given everything that a child would want, you know. And I preface that because I know there's people that grow up in abusive homes that have environmental situations that lead to their alcoholism, and I never had that. And so I was just weird from the get-go, from birth, you know. And I still am. Like, I still feel uncomfortable speaking to people. I still feel uncomfortable around other people. And I'm always in my head, which is where the problem lies. You know, and I can remember being in fifth or first grade or just going to, like, even, like, birthday parties like you do as a kid and being around other kids my age and just feeling weird, you know, feeling like I don't belong, feeling not good enough, like that voice in my head was chattering to me that they're, you know, you're not good enough to play with these kids, stuff like that. And I vividly remember that, just felt weird and uncomfortable around other people except for my family. And, you know, I kind of went through my early life like that. You know, I just was like an introvert, and, you know, people used to always just say, "Oh, Matt, he's really shy," you know, you know, but I was just, you know, an alcoholic waiting for alcohol. I didn't know it yet. So I grew up, my parents split up when I was a kid, but, you know, I don't hang my alcoholism on that by any means. You know, I had, despite, you know, the split, I spent time with both parents, and my mom, like, immediately remarried, and I used to spend, you know, the week with my mother and stepfather, and my stepfather was this strict, really regimented guy, and I resented him a lot of my life because he was really hard on my brother and I, but looking back, I'm grateful for it. You know, it built character and things of that nature, but, you know, when I'm a kid, I hated the guy. But I used to grow up in that environment where I was very strict. You come in, you know, you do your homework before you go outside and play, and you go outside and play before you put the video games on. You know, that's the way my mom and stepdad raised me. And, you know, but I was constantly in trouble, constantly getting grounded in my room and things like that. And I used to go down to my father's house on the weekends, and he was always, like, out dating or out of the house, and he's the complete opposite. My mother's, like, this strict Irish Catholic, you know, woman, and you know, principles and you know, manners. Like, you start with your salad fork and you eat with it, and then you switch it over to your dinner fork. Like, she just beat all that stuff into my brain even as a little kid. And my dad was like, you know, throw a microwave dinner in, and I'm going out on a date. I'll see you guys at midnight. And he was a good guy. Just, so that's where I used to get in trouble. Like, you know, I used to kind of like do what I was told at my mom's, and I'd go down to my dad's house, and I usually reverted to two types of behavior. I would either, you know, stick to myself, and I was completely shy and introverted and then just didn't talk to people, or I would act out to win people's approval. And it was usually around kids I looked up to and things like that. So when I was down at my dad's, and since he was gone, I would invite people over, and we would go, you know, do mischievous stuff and get in trouble. And I got caught a couple times, and then he would tell my mom, and my mom would, you know, lay the hammer down. And that's actually the first place that I discovered alcohol, was at my dad's house. It was, you know, there is alcoholism in my family. My mother's parents were both alcoholic. My grandfather passed away at 55 from liver cancer as a result of just drinking his whole life. My mom's not an alcoholic, but it definitely skipped a generation, I guess. My father doesn't touch his stuff at all. Like, he's just one of these, like, fun-loving guys that doesn't need anything to feel better about himself. But he had liquor in his basement, I went down there with a friend of mine and pulled out the whiskey and took, you know, 5, 6, 7 shots of that stuff into my system, you know, fully set on getting intoxicated because I wanted to see what it was like. And and I immediately loved it. It was like, you know, I didn't like the taste, of course, you know, but it was like that warming effect with every shot, and all of a sudden, like that self-centered fear I kind of felt, like I didn't fit in, it just went away. It was like an incredible experience. I related to like Clark Kent, you know, whipping off, you know, the awkward Clark Kent, like whipping off the suit and the glasses, and I put the Superman cape on. That's the way I felt when I drank, you know, from the get-go. And my buddy, who was kind of a tough guy, like he's not an alcoholic, but he drank and he had the normal reaction. You know, he got sick and he threw up, and he curled up on my dad's couch in the fetal position. And I remember turning to him even and saying, like, you know, I don't even know why people walk around sober. Like, it's such a waste of time. This is so much better to go through life like this. So needless to say, I loved it immediately. Still a little nervous. I wish I could tell you that, like, from that day forward, like, I ran away with it and I got in trouble and my alcoholism immediately took me. But it didn't. And I attest that to the fact that I had the strict regimen at home that I went back to during the week. But I would, you know, when the weekend came, I did drink. But during the week, I did go to school and I did do my homework and I did everything I had to, you know, to get through school. But I couldn't wait to get to the weekend and just party. And that's what alcohol was at first for me. It was just a big party. It was a lot of fun, you know. You know, I'm the guy that left to my own devices, like, I'm weird around other people, but if you give me a couple drinks, I can talk to people, I can dance, I can talk to girls. I don't talk to girls sober. I've never talked to a girl sober in my life before I came up to, you know, into AA. So it was like that, like, magical, like, potion for everything, you know. It just got me out of myself. But there was no negative consequences at first, so I certainly wasn't thinking about giving up. And I didn't think I was an alcoholic because I kept it to the weekends. And I went to college. I graduated high school, and I went off to school in the fall of 1998, and I went to Temple University. And you know, I was a pretty regimented guy at that point. I was a pretty good runner. I ended up actually running track for Temple University for a year, and I went to school when I worked a part time job, And I did pretty well my freshman year, and I did so well that I said, Mom, I don't feel like I'm in college. You know, I feel like I'm in 13th grade because I'm coming home every night. I was commuting into school, you know, and I was like, I want to go away to school. So I went out to a school out in the western part of the state. I was 4 hours away from home, but I could still afford the in-state tuition. And it was my first experience away from home on my own. And you know, the feeling of awkward, like, uncomfortability in my own skin. And I always get like that when I'm in a new place, you know, obsessively. And it was there immediately. So, you know, I turned to drinking, you know, as a comfort. And it was really when I was in that I was in college that it started to progress into an everyday thing and not just the weekend thing. You know, I did pretty well in school my first couple years. It's funny because, like, most people go in and they have that, like, that freshman party year. And they get it out of their system, and then they focus in on their studies. And I was the opposite. I went in, and I was like, you know, I made Dean's List one semester. I actually studied abroad one semester in England for 4.5 months. And I was doing well. But, you know, this thing is progressive. It gets worse. And my alcoholism got worse. And I was going to class less and less. And I started using other substances. But I'll mention those in passing. You know, by the time I was a senior in college, I was a mess. I was drinking and doing other substances pretty much on a daily basis. You know, I was not going to class. I would show up, like, the day of the test and, you know, sit up the whole night before and cram for the test. And somehow, by the skin of my teeth, I passed. And I did get my bachelor's degree. So, so I went home with a mountain of debt. My mother moved to Florida with my stepfather, and I moved back in with my dad, and I did, you know, I got a job, but at this point, the negative consequences, I had gotten arrested a couple times in college for things like public drunkenness and things like that, but, you know, nothing that was enough to make me think about putting down alcohol, and I still didn't think I was an alcoholic. I just thought I'd let my partying go a little too far. But it was like I'd go to work, I'd come home, and I would stop off at the bar every night and pick up alcohol and drink it till I fell asleep. And I did that every night. And my dad was looking at me like I was nuts. And he didn't get why I had to do that every day, you know. And once in a while, I wouldn't do it just so he would get off my back, you know. And inevitably, like most of the positions that I got out of college, I lost as a direct result of my alcoholism. You know, it was either alcohol or some other substance that led to me being fired, and that was kind of like my MO through, you know, post college was I was a very much an unreliable employee. And the truth is, you know, I'm self-centered to, you know. This disease is rooted in self-centeredness, and I was constantly thinking about myself. I didn't care about how good I did at my job. I just wanted to do enough to keep people off my back. I lost one job. Just, I'm resilient, though. I'll pick up and move on to another job. And it was right around this time that I got my first, you know, DUI. So I'm starting to see the negative consequences come into my life. And but still, not enough to quit. I wasn't in enough pain yet, you know. Lost relationships. Almost, you know, every girlfriend I had, I lost as a direct result of drinking and other substances as well. I came to that, you know, I was about 27 years old, and I came to that breaking point in my life. I got my second DUI, and this is the time where I had lost that, like, every job. I was unemployed. I had a mountain of debt, and I just felt complete calamity and anxiety in my mind. I had that voice in my head since I was a kid that told me I'm not good enough, that, you know, I don't fit in, you know, that weird voice that we hear, and, that self-centered fear, that ego. And by this point, it was shouting at me, and it was saying much harsher things than "you're not good enough." And, the progression of this thing for me was that it started off like alcohol was the best treatment for alcoholism. You know, it got me out of self. It was wonderful. And I loved it. But inevitably, it turns on us, you know. And when we get on that downward progression where, you know, negative consequences come, where the party's over and instead of, you know, fun and connectedness to other people, we start drinking alone. We start getting in self-pity, which inevitably happens, you're on the downward slope of alcoholism. And there is no going back. But I kept clinging to the fact that, like, maybe if I just straighten up a few things on the outside, you know, it'll be fun like it was when I was 17 again. But it wasn't, you know. And the truth is, it didn't bring much relief anymore. By the time I was checking out AA at 27, it was giving me just enough relief to sleep a little bit at night, maybe eat a little food without getting sick, and get me out of calamity and anxiety for a couple hours. And that was it. You know, that at best, I drank for oblivion. I drank to pass out for a blackout, you know, because I just didn't like the way I felt, even when I was drunk at that point. They say, you know, pain is the touchstone of spiritual growth. And, I was 27 years old, and at that breaking point, and started checking out AA, but I honestly started checking it out just to, you know, keep, you know, stay out of prison for my DUIs, and, you know, maybe I was dating somebody then, and I didn't want to lose her, and it was like, I hadn't surrendered yet. I was starting to accept the fact that I was an alcoholic, I wasn't completely surrendered, so I got a little bit of time, and I went right back out, and the process had met somebody in the rooms that the light bulb had turned on in this person. Him and I just ended up being friends at first. He was one of those guys, like, you know, he just had it, you know. He was one of the, like, I got out of rehab the first time, and he just came right up to me. I still had the bracelet on my arm. And, you know, he came up, and he, you know, just wanting to spread the message, you know. And I was like, it was a little much, you know. It kind of turned me off. Like, what's this guy want from me? You know, and all he really wanted to do was help me and keep himself sober. And we ended up becoming really good friends. And despite this guy actually lost his license for 7 years. So he used to have to meet me at meetings, like we'd get in a ride. And I used to be like, I went back out, and I'd be like, yeah, I'll meet you at that meeting. And I'd go out and get drunk, not show up. But he never gave up on me, you know. And so when it came time for me to accept this program, and when I had completely surrendered it. And by the time I came in here, like I said, I was just so, there was not one iota of peace in my mind. There was nothing. There was just nothing. There was no empathy for other people. There was no peace of mind. It was just, I felt wretched inside, you know, and I think most people who come into AA can relate with that. We don't come into AA because our lives are great. We're like, hey, let me give this AA thing a shot, you know, because everything's going well. We come in here because we're broken, you know, and that's the way I was. I just felt like completely disconnected from life. And the thing was, like, I knew I couldn't do it anymore, but the thought of life without it still scared me, you know. And the thought of it scared me. I thought at best, like, you know, oh, great, I get to go to AA meetings for the rest of my life. How exciting, you know. That was kind of what I thought. And so it terrified me. And on top of that, the mess I had to clean up terrified me, too. I'm like, how am I going to clean up this wreckage that I've done for the last 10 years? Thank God there's people in this program that do reach out. Thank God it is a pay it forward program. You know, because left to my own devices, I would go back and get drunk until I was dead. No question. You know, that's just the, and people do that in here. That's the sad thing about alcoholism is no joke. It leads a lot of us, you know, into institutions, sanitariums, jails, and some of us, we kill ourselves or we die drunk and alone. And that's the reality of it, you know? So I checked myself back into, I don't want to get into too many war stories. I want to get into the message, obviously, but I have a whole hour, so. So I checked myself back into rehab and, just a complete, like, mess in my head. But I had the willingness. I was like, I know I can't drink anymore, you know. And I called my sponsor, because the guy that I had become friends with, I had asked him before I went in. I said, hey, man, will you sponsor me? Whatever you have, like, I want, you know. You have that peace of mind about you. And his story was relatable to mine. And he didn't hesitate. He said, absolutely, you know. And he was doing everything you're supposed to do in this program. He was working with others, and he was in service, and he was hitting meetings. He was doing everything he was taught to do, and he was praying every day and every night. And you can't deny it when you see it in somebody else, you know. So I was, you know, in rehab, lonely, like we are when we come in here, and just wretched inside. But I was willing, you know, to do whatever you told me to do. And I fought for my time in there. And I was on, you know, public assistance because I didn't have a job. And I went to my counselor like every day, like, get me as much time as you can. I want sobriety. I'll do whatever. I would have stood on my head, like, you know, for an hour a day if you told me that'll keep me sober. I was that willing, you know. I would call my sponsor every night. He would come see me. He dropped off a big book to me when I was still there, you know. And he said, read the doctor's opinion and read all the way up the first 164. And I read it in, like, you know, 3 days. When I wasn't in the rehab sessions and with the counselor, I was in my room reading the big book. And most of it went right over my head. But, you know, I wanted something, you know. And that's really, you know, that's funny because alcoholism to me is like, give me more of something to fill this up because I don't feel good enough, you know. And it, for me, it could be anything, you know. It doesn't even have to be alcohol or drugs. It can be sex. It could be gambling. It could be success in my job. You know, I'll throw myself into my job so that I'm better than you and my numbers look better than you, you know. And use that as a high to get off on, really, you know. And that's kind of what – it's an ego-based, self-centered disease. Like, we love to separate ourselves because rarely in my head am I equal to other people. You know, I'm always not good enough or I'm better than. And that's just a lie. You know, we're all the same. Despite the – we all present outside characters to the world. But, you know, underneath, we really are all the same, you know. And I've seen some of the toughest guys I know break down and cry when they lose a loved one. And I've seen some of the quote-unquote, like, you know, wimpiest people on the outside do some of the most courageous acts you've ever seen, you know. But so it's in all of us, and we're all the same, and we're all struggling with the same stuff. But my ego likes to separate me from other people. And these are things. That's my experience in AA has been, like they call it in the big book, the educational variety. It's like a little bit of an awakening every day. Like you learn something new about yourself. There was no flash of light or anything like that. But the more I throw myself into, you know, this program and work with others and just do little things every day, you know. The light bulb gets a little brighter in me, you know. And sometimes it starts to get dimmer and I feel disconnected, but I ultimately have an answer today to get back to it that doesn't involve putting some kind of mind-altering substance into my body. I got out of, you know, I did the 28-day thing in rehab, and I got out, and I went into a recovery house. I didn't go home. You know, I wasn't going to use my dad's house as a shelter anymore. And I went to a recovery house and started paying like $100 a week rent. And I hit meetings every day. And I started right into the solution, right into the 12 steps. And the way my sponsor explained it to me was like, you know, it's easy to take step one. You know, I mean, look at your life. Just look in the mirror. You're powerless over alcohol. Once it's in your body, you're off to the races, and you know you mentally obsess over it. And they talk about that in the doctor's opinion. You know, it's like a mental obsession combined with a physical allergy, and that's very much true for me. You know, and I knew I could not put it into my system. I was powerless over alcohol, and you know it led me, like that list of I'll nevers just got short. Like I'll never cheat. I'll never manipulate people to get what I want, and you end up doing that. I'll never steal. I ended up doing that. You know, and it took me to places that were horrible. And that's the other thing you come in here with is that guilt, you know, and shame of your actions as a result of alcoholism. So I got right into the solution, and we did it right out of the big book, you know. And I always had a concept of God. I grew up, going to church with my family, and I never really connected with that God. I mean, I think religion's great. I think religion is opens doors to people to have a spiritual experience and be better people, and that's ultimately religion and spirituality is all about. But it was hard for me to relate with a God that like knew what I thought and knew everything I did, that sat above me, and you know, I didn't want that God because I had crazy thoughts in my head. You know, I was nuts. I didn't want him to know what was going around in my brain. And But I was also, you know, they talk about like how every man, woman, and child has the fundamental idea of God in them, and I was like that too. I'm a searcher, you know. I always look for things I want to understand things, and I was definitely like that person, just like most of us. You look up at the stars at night, you wonder, wow, that's like amazing. There's this like vast and endless universe, so there's got to be something vast and endless behind it, and so I had that kind of concept, and it just started with that simple. And it was like, hey, just turn it over to whatever power created the universe every day, you know. And I did. And I stopped praying for selfish things. It wasn't like, you know, I definitely did the foxhole prayers, like, get me out of this one. And I definitely did the prayers like, oh, you know, please let me win the lottery so I can pay my bills and that type of stuff. And those prayers don't get answered, you know. But when you pray to get out of self and you pray for willingness to do the right thing and you pray for other people, those prayers are answered, you know. And it was like about bringing God's will into my life, not my will. You know, get me out of the way and just let something else come into me. And that was the beginning of it. It was simple as like getting down on my knees at night, thanking him, and getting it first thing in the morning, you know, just turning it over. And I still do that to this day, you know. And it's important for me to stay connected. I get in a routine, though. I don't know if people here do that, but like, I say like the third step prayer and the seventh step prayer. I have them memorized, you know. You're almost like reading off a script. So it's important for me anyway to like, when I get down on my knees, try to have feeling in it, you know, and really turn it over and not just say some words and go to sleep at night. So, I get into that routine. I'm sure a lot of us here do. And then, you know, after my sponsor and I did the first three steps, we started on my inventory, and the best analogy I have for the inventory is like, kind of like our heads are like basements. You know, basements are the place in the house where we store everything, and you know, there's a lot of crap down there that needs to get out. And so the fourth step was the beginning of the process of inventorying of what am I holding on to that's blocking me off from being in the moment and being of service to other people. Because, you know, if I'm obsessing about something, which resentment and fear are huge in my life, it blocks me off in the moment. I've been in meetings before even and, like, just heard about 10 minutes of the speaker, you know, because I'm up in my head about what happened at work or, you know, what happened the day before or what she said to me yesterday, you know. So it was like, you know, just, let's get it down on paper and let's get the stuff out that's blocking you let's get it out. And that was just the beginning. And then the fourth step is just simple. It's just putting pen to paper and just writing the things that block us. It's easy. I know me personally, like I can take other people's inventory real well. You know, I can definitely look at you and hold judgments against you about everything that you're doing wrong. And definitely keep me out of the situation. It's a little harder to look at yourself and look at your part in the situation. And that's the other part of the fourth step is I had that column in my fourth step, my part in the situation. Because we have to start looking at ourselves. The one thing that this program has given me, and it's not perfect by any means, but is the ability to like keep the focus on the defects of character to myself. The flip side of that coin is, you know, if somebody else steps on my toes, can I look at them as spiritually sick people? Can I forgive them for what they did to me, you know? Because a lot of times when people do, you know, things that anger us, a lot of times, not always, but a lot of times it has nothing to do with us. It's just they're going through something in their lives that we don't even know about, but we take everything so personally. It's tough, though. I struggle with that. You know, I'm definitely the... I'm the first guy that, like, when somebody, you know, cuts me off in traffic, I want to lay on the horn, you know. But that's the thing. This program is something that I need in every aspect of my life. It's not something that I can do an hour a day and sit in a chair and get growth from. You know, it has to be applied at work. It has to be applied at home. It has to be applied in every aspect of my life. And when I get disconnected today, I feel it. You know, I definitely feel that self-centered fear and anger, and it usually starts as like a slight background anxiety. I feel it creep back into my life, and I feel completely disconnected. Now, I don't drink today, but I can feel that alcoholism talking to me, you know? And if I let it go long enough, that same voice is going to click back on in my head and tell me, like, hey, why don't you drink? You'll feel better, you know? And there's a sick part of me that wants me drunk, alone, and dead. And I know that today. That's the nice thing. I have the awareness today, but awareness alone will not, you know, relieve my alcoholism. I definitely have to take action, and it starts with that fourth step, you know. And I've done actually two, and I'm about to do a third one. You know, you should do your tenth step every night. I'm not going to, you know, lie and say that I do. I do it on most nights. You know, and for me, it's like a journal. I just write down, you know, where was I self-seeking, resentful, dishonest, fearful today? Did I, you know, in turn take action as a result of feeling that way, that I stepped on someone's toes, and do I have to make amends? And then you chalk up the good stuff you do too. You should, if you're living a spiritual program, you're inevitably doing something good for somebody that day. So you don't have to be so hard on yourself. At least that's what I was taught. And I did. So I got onto the fifth step, and it was my sponsor and I went to a meeting. It ended up being like a fifth step meeting. It was like it was meant to be. And right after the meeting, we went back to his place and we did my fifth step. And it was like, they say that's when you'll feel the nearness of your creator, when you start, you know, confess it, when you go through your fifth. If nearness of your creator means just like peace of mind and ability to be in the moment and relieved of some of that, like that definitely happened to me. There's that old saying, our secrets keep us sick. And it's the same reason I wanted to say I was nervous as soon as I stepped up here, because if I kept it in and tried to be confident, you guys would have seen right through me. that getting that, letting the cat out of the bag, just letting that stuff out, it definitely, like, there's absolute power in that relieves you of those feelings. And it's like clarity of mind, serenity, ability to be in the moment, all those things come to you. But again, mine is an educational variety. So as quick as those things, you know, I get that relief from doing this work, it can go away too if I don't practice spiritual maintenance. And the analogy I like to use is like if you go to the gym, if you like to exercise and stay physically in shape, you know, you can't work out for a month and then take 2 months off and still think you're going to be in shape. It doesn't work like that. It's a lifestyle. You do it every day. It's the same thing with our spirit. It's something that we have to do every day. And you can't just do it by, you know, an hour a day sitting in a room trying to absorb information. It's something that you have to take action on. Then after the fifth, we moved on. Right out of the big book, I spent an hour reflecting on my other defects of character and asked God to help remove them. And, you know, I certainly understand why they focus so much on resentment and fear, because those are the things that will lead us back to a drink without question. when I'm at most uncomfortable in my own skin and stuff is when I'm resentful and fearful, you know, and it takes me completely out of the moment. But I certainly have other defects of character. I'm a people pleaser, you know. I want everybody to like me, you know, so I'll do whatever it takes so that you like me, because I have that, you know, I struggle with that ego reflection. Like, you want everybody else to pat you on the back and say it's okay, you know. And I've had that. I've struggled with that my whole life. And I can be very, you know, self-centered. I have a temper. I can lose my temper and be angry. There's like a whole ton of defects of character that are in there. And I really do, as part of my spiritual program, try to spend some time reflecting on them and taking action to get out of them. But I struggle with a lot of them too, you know, and that's okay, because, you know, I'm not, you know, a spiritually perfect person. I'm a human being, and you know, it's hard sometimes for me to let go of things that I've done, like, and forgive myself. I don't know if anybody else in here struggles with that, but like, if I mess up, man, I'll replay that over in my head. And that's not, like, resentment means to refeel. And like, when I screw up and do something wrong, like, I just replay it and replay it in my head, and I keep myself disconnected and sick. And I'm really hard on myself. Like, nobody said things, you know, worse to me than I've said in my own head. But those other defects of character are something that you can work with your sponsor on. You can talk about. There is action that you can take to work on those defects of character. You know, and then it came, you know, 8 and 9, making our amends. Like, and again, that just, step 8 just starts with writing, like putting pen to paper. And that's all it is. You know, we get so scared of like the 4th and 8th, and really it's writing. That's all it is, you know. It's just spending some time reflecting on your life and who do I owe an amends to? And you know, amends, I always thought it was like just going up and just, hey, I'm sorry, please forgive me. But it's really about like taking action, and if there's something that you can do that they want you to do to make it right, you should do it, you know, including financially or whatever. It's a humbling experience. You know, I went to all my old employers and made amends. And, you know, I got that dirty look when I walked in the door. And I was, like, terrified to do it, you know, and, you know, clammy and up in my head. But I always said a prayer right before I did it, you know, keep me out of self. Just let me think about the other person here and try to make this right. I don't know if I was lucky, but almost everybody whose toes I had stepped on, they did forgive me, you know. And I had old employers who basically threw me out, like shake my hand and say, man, come back anytime. We'd love to see you again. And you can't help when you leave that and feel like connected and good. You know, it's inevitable. There's absolute power in it. You know, I went into a liquor store that I stole from, and I offered to pay for the booze that I stole. You know, it was bottom shelf stuff, but even when I stole, I was bottom shelf. But I walked in like terrified, you know, you know, like, oh man, they could call the cops on me. But I had that like wonderful experience. The guy almost looked at me like I was crazy, but he like shook my hand. He was like, thanks for coming in. He's like, we actually, you know, we write that stuff off. But I offered to pay for it, but he said I was good. I guess I should pay for it. But you know, I even made an amends to, part of my story is other substances, and I even made an amends to a dealer that I owed $600 to, and I called him up and I paid him, and I was like jammed up about that too. Like, do I do this? I mean, it was. But my sponsor called me on it, and he's like, listen, you owe the person money, you pay them, you know? And I did. And he tried to, you know, finagle more money out of me, of course. But again, it was just a humbling experience. And the rule of thumb here is just you think about the other person, not yourself. And that's tough because I always think about myself. I'm an alcoholic. again, it's almost like the things in life that I'm terrified of, that I'm afraid to do. Once I do them, I feel like relieved of self. You know, it like I feel that much more connected to people by doing it. And that self-centered fear is really what's blocked me off from relationships with other people and a higher power my whole life. And the steps are kind of, they wake you up to that. You know, you're supposed to live in 10, 11, and 12. And you know, again, I told you about the personal inventory. I try to do it every night, but. you just spend some time reflecting, you know, there's a saying in AA, you know, life gets good, life gets real good, and then life gets real. And that certainly was my experience, you know, But no matter how busy I am or what I have going on in my day, I can't forget the principles that got me here, because those are the first things that I'll lose, you know. And but I do. I get in me. My experience in sobriety has been like the light bulb goes on. I'm on that path of serenity and connectedness. And then, you know, you give me my job and my car and a relationship with a woman, and I'm, you know, I'm 50% alcoholic now, so I'll go to like two meetings a week, and you know, that's what I do. And I get that disconnect, and then I start feeling like I'm snapping at people. I start feeling anxious about my job. I start feeling weird around other people again. I feel it. Absolutely. I can't sleep at night. It's just a good reminder to me that, you know, just because I don't put the bottle to my lips anymore, I'm still an alcoholic. And then I inevitably have to get back on that path. I'm like, I got to get out of self, and I got to dig in and think about other people, and you know, start doing an inventory and what's blocking me off. But it never fails to get me reconnected again, especially working with others, just getting out of self. So, you know, and then 11, prayer and meditation. I don't know if anybody here struggle with it. I struggle with meditation. I always had this concept of like Eastern meditation, like cross your legs, you know, hands on your knees and meditate. And I can't quiet my mind. Like, it's a freight train constantly, you know. It's really difficult for me. But for the old, you know, big book version of meditation is just, you know, listening to God. They say prayer is asking and meditation is listening. So, I mean, what I do is I pray in the morning, and before I go to work, I say that there's like a prayer in the 12 and 12. About God, you know, grant that I may seek to comfort rather than to be comforted, to understand than to be understood. It's like a prayer about getting out of self and thinking about other people. And I say that, and then I almost meditate on it like for 5-10 minutes and just clear my mind with that. Because for me, like, I've gotten out of bed in the morning, and like instantly, like, the resentment machine turns on. Like, I'm in the shower and I'm like that, you know, I'm thinking about something somebody said to me last week, and I go to work and I'm snapping at people before we're even getting our morning coffee, because I'm in yesterday thinking about something that somebody said to me. I'm that nuts and disconnected at times, you know. So that meditation is just, for me, it's like a good way to bring me back to the moment and get out of the craziness in the head, you know. And then 12, you know, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry the message to alcoholics and practice principles in all our affairs. And it's not just carrying the message to other alcoholics, and that's absolutely important that we work with others, but practice principles in all our affairs. You know, this is a lifestyle for us. It's a spiritual program of action. The 12 steps in the big book are called a guideline to living. It never says the 12 steps, this is how you get sober. You know, it just happens to keep us sober. But it's absolutely like it's a lifestyle for me. It's something that I practice, like I said, at work, at home, and all my affairs. It's very important that I constantly pay this forward. You know, selfless people came up to me and got me out of my head and got me on that path towards serenity. And it's absolutely, you know, it's paramount that I do that as well and work with others, you know. Sometimes the guys I work with, they call me right at that opportune time when I'm in my head. And it never fails. I'm like up in my head about something at work or in my day, and a guy will call me with a problem, and you know, you help talk him off the ledge and you know, guide him towards some action, and you feel better again. You know, you feel centered. That's how it works. It just getting out of your head, because that's where the problem lies. The problem centers in my mind. So some of the gifts that I've received as a result of this program, you know, I talked about life gets good, life gets real good, life gets real. You know. I threw myself into this program, you know, right out of rehab, the step work. You know, I started making coffee and got a home group and did everything I was asked to do. And that's key today, that I remain sponsorable. You know, once you think you know this thing and you have it, you know, you're in trouble. And I still call my sponsor to this day, obviously, you know, not as much. But I need you know, sometimes I need guidance, because my head lies to me and tells me things that separate me from other people. And if I act out on them, then I got to make amends And I usually have a whole mess I got to clean up. So it's important that I remain sponsorable. But some of the gifts that I've got are, you know, at 10 months sober, I went into the Navy to pay some bills. you know, I enlisted. I have a bachelor's degree, but I had to enlist because they wouldn't let me go officer with DUIs on my record. I was deployed overseas right out of A school on a carrier right over to the, you know, the Arabian Sea. I did that in 2009 and 2010, and I got to see all these cool countries. Like, we're pulling into port in Antalya, Turkey, and Naples, Italy, and I'm like, this is amazing, you know? And I was real popular at port call because one guy in the groups, when they let you off, has to stay sober, and everyone knew I was in AA. So everybody wanted me to join their group. Real popular at port call. And I'm going through the Suez Canal, and I'm seeing, like, Egyptian kids, like, wave to us. It was this amazing experience, you know? And I got to enjoy every moment of it, you know, by practicing principles and being in the moment. And it just made me a better, you know, sailor. It made me better at what I did by being able to think about other people and be in the moment. This program will work in all aspects of your life. And there's been, you know, ups and downs in my life as well. I mean, in the 2010 deployment, my mom got extremely sick, and she passed away. And it was all of a sudden, it was one of those things like here today, gone tomorrow. And they flew me home to go to the funeral, and I had to go home, you know, go to my mom's funeral and turn around and finish the deployment. But I never once thought about drinking. My stepdad, who was a tough guy his whole life, was a mess. He couldn't keep it together. So whatever I could do to help him around the house, I did. It was just that little thing. And this thing is about the whole principle thing. It could be as simple as like something like you're at work, you're going to get a cup of coffee, ask the guy to your left or the girl to your right, hey, do you want a cup of coffee? I'm going to get one. It's stupid stuff like that. Like, just think about other people, you know? And I did that to get through the passing of my mother. I flew home. I finished the deployment. I came back, and, I got a job right out of – I did 2 years, and I'm still a reservist. So I still drill 1 week in a month. That was a contract I signed. And I started interviewing right away, and I got a job. And there were some gaps in employment on my resume, and they asked me about it, and I was honest about it. You know, I said, listen, I'm an alcoholic. I didn't always live my life the right way, and I practice principles today that have not only allowed me to be sober but be better at everything I do. I'm proud of that fact, and I said, but I'm not going to sit here and lie to you and say that those gaps in employment are I took a long vacation, you know. And the guy actually told me a year after they hired me, he said, man, it was fun. We were at a conference. He was actually a little drunk, but he's like, yeah, man, when you said that in the interview, he's like, that actually, like, I admired that. And he's like, I turned to the other guy who interviewed me. It was a two-person interview. And he said, we need to hire this guy right away. And it was like, it was awesome, you know. I mean, I'm so scared to tell the truth sometimes, but really, it's the fear that's blocking me from doing the right thing. It's all in my head, you know. And I've had amazing experiences since then, you know. I get to do all these, like, I thought sobriety would be like boring, like go to a meeting, come home, you know, eat dinner, watch TV, and go to bed. And I've got to do, like, I went skydiving when I was in the Navy once, and like. I picked up snowboarding last winter, something new I tried, you know, and I got my butt kicked, but I gave it a shot. 31 years old, giving it a shot on the slopes. I started, like, clay pigeon shooting and doing all this, like, fun stuff, like, playing me and my buddies, all from AA. Some of them are here, actually, tonight. We play paintball on Sundays. And it's, like, that's all the kind of stuff I always wanted to do. I always had these adventures planned in my head. I want to try this. I want to try that. But, you know, it got in the way with my drinking, so, and it cost too much. I've had these amazing experiences that are just – there are times when I just stop and pause, and I'm like, I'm so grateful that I get to have these experiences, that I have real relationships with people today, you know. Like when I say I'm going to go to work, I go to work, and I don't leave right at 5 o'clock. You know, if they need me to stay till 6 or 6:30, I stay and I work. And it gives me a sense of accomplishment, and I feel like I'm being of service to my employer, you know, and I leave feeling great, you know, and that never was in me. That's not naturally in me. Naturally in me is like, let's get out of work at 5 and get drunk, you know. So there's absolutely a power in this program, in this spiritual guideline for living, that keeps us connected to other people. And like I said, I'm repeating myself, but it just makes us better in everything we do. And there are times in my life where I do get away from it, and I feel that it feels like calamity almost in the head, you know. It feels like I definitely will, when I'm disconnected, will think about everything in my life that I don't have, that's not good enough. I'll compare myself to other people, and I lose that gratitude, and I lose that peace of mind, and I lose the moment because I'm in tomorrow, I'm in yesterday, I'm in, well, they have a nicer car than I do. I mean, who wants to go through life like that, right? I mean, isn't the point of life, I mean, you should have that attitude of gratitude. You should have a peace of mind about you. And part of that is just as simple as surrendering every day and giving it up to God. And just even part of your reflection can be, and I've done this, is just, you know, I'm doing my inventory and I'm chalking up those things in my head that are blocking me. Well, let's do a list of the things in my life that I've gotten as a result of practicing these principles. Look how grateful you should be for all these things you have in your life. But I'm still, you know, even when I get good things, like I still have that voice that says you're not good enough and you got lucky. You know, like I'm doing pretty well at my job and you know, I get the pat on the back that I always see because I'm a people pleaser, and I feel weird again. I'm like, oh, I don't really deserve this, you know. I didn't really earn this. I got lucky. I still have that alcoholic thinking, you know, that loves to tell me that I'm not good enough. And again, it's a reminder. But I also have that awareness that that's a lie, you know. That's ego-based. It's fear-based. It's not true. It feels real, but I'm able to keep practicing principles and kind of let it go in this ear and out that ear. And I reach out to people when I'm in that mindset as well, my sponsor, my grand sponsor, and they talk me off the ledge and they remind me that, you know, hey, you have a lot to be grateful for, you know, shut up and go help other people and you'll feel it again, you know? And it really is true. And I it's funny. I find myself, you know, paying the same or you know, spreading the same message to my sponsees. And sometimes it doesn't even feel like it came out of me. It's just like what was passed on to me, I pass on to others. And when I'm passing it on to others, I feel that connection and I feel peace of mind and I'm grateful for what I have, you know, and it's just a wonderful feeling, you know. Sometimes I feel so connected to other people and grateful. It's like almost the effect you got from alcohol at first. You know, you're just in a grateful, peaceful state of mind. Everything's okay. You're not judgmental. And you can be in the moment and have fun and enjoy life, you know. I can't rest on my laurels. I certainly have to practice these principles for the rest of my life. But I'm grateful for that, you know. Even the things in life that, quote, unquote, are hard, that cause pain. I mean, don't we inevitably grow from those experiences the most? And you know, I don't see the big picture. You know, sometimes what sucks today could be a blessing for tomorrow. I just don't see the big picture. I'm in my head and I'm, you know, I'm like, oh, this sucks. But, you know, inevitably it could turn out to be something good. It could lead me to somebody that I can help, or it could lead me to something else that I don't know. Again, because I'm not running the universe. I don't see the big picture. I'm getting close to the end. I can't believe I almost made it an hour. I'll just close with, you know, left to my own devices, I'm a head case. I'm completely disconnected, and I'm judgmental. I'm pissed off. I'm scared of everything, and I'm drunk. And with this program, you know, I'm connected. I'm peaceful. I'm grateful. I'm selfless instead of selfish. I get empathy towards other people. And it's nice to feel for other people, you know, because I was so stuck in self for so long. It's nice when you can look at somebody else struggling and actually have compassion towards them and feel what they're going through and want to help them, you know. And that is ultimately how you're connected, you know. And I've gotten all those. And I got sober, too, you know, as a result of doing this. So, I mean, who wouldn't want that in their life, you know. It does require work. It does require you to take a look at yourself. And there is some pain in that, but you grow from that. And that's inevitably what I keep in the back of my mind when I'm going through something difficult. Is like, you know what, this, I might grow from this and become a better person. You know, it's back and forth. It's that, you know, self-centered, you know, side of me that takes over at times. And then there's that connected side of me that takes over at times. And I know I'm never going to be like, you know, Buddha or, you know. I can stay sober each day. I can be happy for the most part. I can have serenity in my life. And I can get through anything by practicing these principles and all my affairs. And with that, I'll close. Thank you.